Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and my guest for this special bonus episode is the godfather of British comics, the creator of Nemesis, of Slane, of Roebusters, Charlie's War, Martial Law, Requiem, Vampire Knight, the comics Battle, Action, 2000 AD itself, Misty, and so much more. He's also the person with the best middle name in all of comics. It's a very warm book club welcome this morning to Pat Mills. Welcome, Pat.
Good morning, Eamon. And my middle name is Eamon. And in fact, I'm looking at how you spell it and I realize that's the correct spelling. And of course, I think I've been misspelling it all these years with just one N. So I'm making a note of that. I'm assuming you have some Celtic origins.
Yes, my parents are both from Dublin.
Right. I thought as much. Yeah. We're everywhere.
We are indeed. So, Pat, we're going to talk about your most recent book, Page Turners. But before we do that, when I get new guests on the book club, I always start with their own comics origin stories. And, of course, I've heard you talk about British comics a lot, but I don't think I've heard you say much about your own first comics that you were reading as a child. Was it comics or books or both?
Well, I read lots of books. I suppose anyone who's, you know, who writes for a living probably has that background. And I suppose I should have a comic background, but you've noticed that I rarely talk about it. And that's because I didn't follow comics particularly, with one exception, which I'll get onto. But for the most part, you know, in those teenage years where so many teenagers are discovering Brian Bolland or Jack Kirby or someone like that, I discovered cartoons, and I was a complete cartoon buff. So if you were, if there was another cartoon buff, I could easily have a very long and probably boring conversation about cartoons in Private Eye or Mad Magazine or Punch, because I used to get Punch every week and Private Eye every fortnight. So I suppose I was as rabid about cartoons as so many comic readers are about comic strip. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely collected them, loved them, and knew all the different artists and why their stuff was cool and so on. So when it came to comics, the one that stands out, and I think it's a good one, that it does stand out, is Wolf the Briton by Ron Embleton, which was in Express Weekly. And you asked me about, what did I take away from that? What was it about that? And I think you were right to ask that question, because those stories had really good structure, which I can still remember. And I probably subconsciously, and perhaps even consciously, employed in my work. The one that springs to mind was where there were seven tests for Wolf the Briton. I think he was a gladiator or something. So he had to achieve seven different objects, which probably, I would guess, probably took him two or three weeks, two or three episodes. And the frustration, of course, is they were my cousin's copies of Express Weekly. So I only got to read about two or three of them, but they obviously left a very strong impression. And I think alongside structure, there was also the brilliance of Embleton's artwork, the authenticity of it, and the fact that this was a rebellious character. I mean, this was a Briton up against the Roman forces. I don't think we should underestimate that. I mean, if you look at Eagle, which would have been contemporary with it, you would have had Luck of the Legion at that time. So what have you got? You've got French guys colonizing North African rebels, and they're seen as a positive force. So I think Wolf the Briton, even though I only got to read a few episodes because it was my cousin's comics, I think it probably left quite a profound impression on me. I mean, Eagle I rarely read, because I think it was too expensive. I think it was a bit pricier than Express Weekly. And I did occasionally read Hotspur and comics like that. But for the most part, it was cartoons. And I suppose the one I should mention, of course, is Ronald Searle, who very much influenced not just my generation, but subsequent generations with things like Centrinians and Down With School and so forth.
I, not long ago, did a podcast with Tony Esmond about Ronald Searle and Down With School.
I'm so pleased. It's really important.
Yeah.
And I don't know what Tony's take on it was, but we both went to the same wretched schools. I think this it was probably a very cathartic two fingers up to the school we both went to.
And I'm fascinated about Wolf the Briton because, as you say, a rebellious character, a character that's resisting. And I know I'm jumping ahead slightly, but if I'm thinking about Slane later on and some of his time-travelling adventures, because he also will resist Roman invaders at one point, I can see that streak of rebelliousness in your characters and your stories. So I'm fascinated that Wolf the Briton was there at the beginning.
Yeah. And if I think about it, a lot of what would now be called YA fiction would tend to focus on the Celts versus the Romans, not necessarily in a positive way. So I think with Slane, I think it was really trying to put that right. So, for example, my recollection is Rosemary Sutcliffe was one of the strongest YA historical writers. And I distinctly recall not liking what she was writing. I mean, I was hungry to read everything in the library. You know, so I was vacuuming up books. And I distinctly recall disliking certain authors and not knowing why. And I'll maybe come on to that later without getting too psychological and weird about it. But it's the muse. It's that whatever is within you pushes you in certain directions. Although it was very early on, it was basically saying Rosemary Sutcliffe is not for you. And while we're on the subject, similarly, I think so many kids read C.S. Lewis at the time, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I wouldn't say there was an inner voice saying, this is not for you, but it wasn't far off. It was saying, no, you don't go there. And as I say, I was hungry I would look out for every top author that was around. So I was very aware of these different people. And in the case of the Celts, they were given a rather patronizing, you know, a viewpoint. In other words, the Romans were a good thing. I don't think that came across in Ron Embleton's work so much. I think it was perhaps more of a level playing field. But I think elsewhere, I think, was it Henry or Geoffrey Treece? I always get them muddled up. They were presenting the Romans in a fairly positive way. And of course, that's a reflection of school curriculums, which tend to do that. So the relevance to this is that I really needed to have a very anti-Roman perspective in Slane. And so it was an important story for me when Slane goes time traveling and really gets to trash the Roman Empire, because it's an insidious, corrupt force that was still brainwashes us to this day. It's not just incidental. History is incredibly selective in school curriculums, and that's something I tried to put right. Probably a frustrated history teacher.
Well, let's move on to today's book, because obviously I've invited you on to talk about Page Turners, which you published at the end of last year, 2023, How to Write Iconic Stories from the Creator of 2000 AD, from Millsverse Books, there it is, cover art by Mike Donaldson, edited by Lisa Mills. Now, previously, you'd done, obviously, Be Pure, Be Vigilant, Behave, The Secret History of 2000 AD and Judge Dredd, You've done Kiss My Axe, The Secret History of Slaying. This is a different book in that it's not sort of a history or a memoir. What was your inspiration and intention when you set out to write it?
I think there's a little bit of fear, really, thinking all the things that that I'd learned and other writers have learned the hard way were not necessarily carrying on to new generations. And I mean, when you learn these things, you think, Christ, I'm not going to do that again. And then you realize, then you see new generations of writers or editors making the same mistakes. So I think that was a really potent thing for me. I mean, I'll give you one very tiny example. And it still goes on to this day. And you think, Christ, okay, you don't have to necessarily read my book. But you would imagine that the message would have gotten out there. You have to have the hero's, the protagonist's name in the title. And if you look at all the successful fiction, for that, there will be the odd exception, but for the most part, you know, whether it's Batman or Sherlock Holmes or whatever, the hero's name is either in the title or above the title, as it were. In other words, so and again, you look at Slain or Judge Dredd and so forth. And so if you have a story, I'm thinking back to, was it Summer of Love in 2000 AD? Which I think many readers like, but it restricts its success because the hero's name isn't in the title. So I wanted to pass on all those kind of tips and a lot else beside. With writing guides, you know, everyone you know who would like to write comics or novels or film, you know, turns to a writing guide at one point or another. And they all miss out on saying some really uncomfortable truths. And page turners has all those uncomfortable truths. Like, for example, the truth about agents. The world of agents is, you know, the assumption with these other books is, well, if you write a really good story or whatever, doors will open for you. They won't open for you. It may be to do with an agent. It may be to do with an editor or whatever. But there are all sorts of other doors that you've got to unlock. And page turners gets into those, principally things like agents. Gets onto the very sensitive subject of networking, which. I can't recall one writing guide which mentions the importance of networking. And by the way, I hate networking, but it's something I have to do. I mean, you know, traditionally writers were sort of lonely souls stuck in a garret and, you know, they didn't sort of get out much and they spent all their time writing and so on. And I think that's the image I always thought was the case. And, but networking is probably more and more today the case. It's important. And there's also other truths that needed to be covered, like independent publishing. And that's the good news, is that with independent publishing, you can break that middle-class hold on fiction. In other words, you've got your sort of... main publishers, and getting a book past them is quite tricky, is very tricky. So I wanted to pass on all that information and a lot else beside. In other words, how you present a story, I think, is quite important. As a discipline, I still struggle with myself, but I know it's there and I have to do it. So if I'm submitting something to a new publisher, for instance, which I still occasionally do to this day, you know, you might start off with a single-page pitch, the elevator pitch, if you like. That's bloody hard because you've done all this work. You've worked out this incredible trilogy or whatever, and you've got to reduce it to one page. And then, in my view, the next stage is is a three-page synopsis, because the editor has a really short attention span. He does not want to read your page breakdown, scene breakdown that goes on page after page after page. So I cover these kind of things and I explain why. And I think they're just as important as all the other aspects of creative writing. So there's a lot there. And in particular, what inspires you to write? That's the real engine of page turners. Why do you want to write in the first place? That's a big question.
Now, you talked a little bit about being a history teacher. You'd written these last two books that were both secret histories. In the structure of this book, of course, you've set out to deliver some of this sort of instructional guidance about the various processes that people have to go through to write something and get it published and so on. But of course, you've got this great advantage that you've got so many stories and histories of your own in which to sort of sample from. And you've mentioned that you're going to get, you know, you talk about the synopsis, the elevator pitch. Along the way, you've got an awful lot of back matter, as it were, to go back to and tell some of this story as you go. Did you find that, you know, a useful structure to set out for readers?
Yeah, I think so. What I tend to do is whatever I'm working on at the time tends to be reflected in things like page turners. So although I've got this huge back catalogue, which I do refer to, and the reason, of course, I have such a huge back catalogue, by the way, is because anyone who makes a living in British comics has to have a pretty big back catalogue, because the money isn't very good, and therefore you've got to get a lot of stuff out there. So that's the reason. If it were, say, I work for France, but say I worked for France originally, I would probably have only half that number of books. So I tend to feature whatever is currently on my mind. So at the time I was writing page turners, I was very into particular characters for a novel series I'm working on, because I discovered a great villain and I wanted to share that with the audience, but also to draw to their attention the importance of finding a good villain and how rare they are and the reasons that they are rare. I mean, if you just have an ordinary villain, well, you know, what's going to make your book or comic strip stand out from others? So, you know, to find a Torquemada or a Judge Death or a Lord Weird Slough Fegg from Slane, they don't come along easily. And when you find one, you've got to really hold on to it and really develop it and do things with it. Because villains are quite hard to pin down. So, for example, in my view, one of the greatest villains of all time is Tony Blair. He's a war criminal. But I don't know him personally. I don't know enough about him. And I would find it very hard to dramatize him in fictional form because he is so slippery. And I suspect an awful lot of villains are. You know, so I found a really strong villain, which I refer to in page turners, called Captain Pollard. A real-life guy, real-life James Bond, and an absolute monster. And the more I read about him, the more I thought, wow, what a fantastic villain. So it's whatever's going on for me whenever I'm writing that tends to feed into things like page turners, yeah.
Now, you've also mentioned the muse, and that features quite heavily in your book. You talk about why people want to write, about this process of getting from idea to being published somewhere. I wonder if you could say something about the muse and how you used it in your book, because it's not always just like the conventional idea of somebody or something that inspires you in your book.
Yeah, it's a big thing. I think we live in very rational times, and therefore the muse is kind of a, oh, well, where do you get your ideas from? Oh, that's really interesting. Oh, yeah, well, you spent a few years in the Middle East, so that's why the Middle East features in your stories. It's very dismissive. But if you were to go back to ancient Greece, for example, the muse is actually honored as a triple goddess. It's recognized as a force. Now, its exact nature, I'm not qualified to. I can only conjecture what it is. It's some kind of psychic energy. What I can say unequivocally is it's other. It's not me. It comes into me, and I hope it will hang around and stay. But it's almost separate, and it motivates. It motivates in a different way to if you've, say, been in the army. So you might write about your army experiences. Now, people would say, oh, well, your army experiences inspired your book. That's not true. It's absolutely not true. It's whatever is within you. What are you trying to say? So in my case, my muse, if one was to define her, and we normally give it a female definition. It's sort of known as a female entity. It's very anti-establishment. Quite exactly the boundaries of that, I don't know. It's, what shall we say? It's certainly anti the Catholic Church, which features quite heavily in my stories. And I think to a lesser degree, it's anti establishment politics, things like that. So that's what drives me. So the relevance of this is that if, for example, I was to write a story that the muse was not interested in, that story is going to go nowhere. And that's important for a prospective writer. They might think, oh, you know, why am I writing? Well, I like superhero comics and you know, I want to make money and comics are fun. So they start writing for superheroes, let's say, and they don't get anywhere. And the reason is, alongside all the other factors like networking and natural abilities, there's another reason as well. Their personal muse may not be interested in superheroes. Certainly my muse is not interested. So I rarely, if ever, you know, cross the divide and actually write superheroes. But whereas my muse is quite happy for me to write martial law, who hates superheroes, that's fine. This all sounds a bit pathological, but whether we admit it or not, that's at the heart of this. I'll give you an actual example. My ex-wife, Angela Kincaid, the co-creator of Slain, we worked on another project together called The Butterfly Children, which was aimed at quite young children. And it subsequently went on to be a great success for Angela. But in the early stages, I was quite into it because I liked the idea of the protagonist, which still applies even for young children. You still have all those dramatic aspects and values being... what do they call them? A common white butterfly. So you can see how my kind of working class roots are turning up even there. Oh, it's not one of the more exotic butterflies. It's a cabbage white. That's what they called them. And so I was really keen. I was getting into it. And then at a certain point, an entrepreneur came along and bought the rights to Butterfly Children for a great sum of money. And he said, no, we don't want the cabbage white. We want whatever it is, monarch butterflies, exotic butterflies from all over the world. And I rapidly lost interest, or rather my muse rapidly lost interest. And so at a particular point, I dropped out and left Angela to it. And so that's an example. And I think if I was to try writing anything that didn't have that personal axe to grind, you know, it's not going to fly. And that will be true for other writers as well. So you've got to know, why are you writing? What is it you want to say? Now, I'm always envious of some of the arguably blander writers like P.G. Wodehouse with Jeeves. It's wonderful. He's spent his whole life writing these wonderful light comedies about social class. So his muse was giving him a very easy time. My muse doesn't. And I suspect that's true for others. So whatever you're writing about, whether it's football or science fiction or war, there will always be an underlying subtext. And the writer has to understand themselves, why am I doing it? And if the answer is because I'm going to make money at it, it's just not good enough. It will trip you up.
Now, Pat, I was at the Lawless Convention in Bristol a couple of weeks ago, and I was speaking to some fans who were talking about your book and how helpful they found it in their own writing and trying to get their own project started and hopefully come to fruition. You mentioned in the book a few examples of popular culture, modern books, TV and films that inspire you, that sometimes visit you at the Muse. Are there good examples in there in modern popular culture that other writers and readers can look at to learn about writing and structure?
You mean fictional examples,
yes,
or non-fiction?
Fictional.
Well, fiction examples, I was thinking about that. Well, the role model that I use, and I, you know, you always have to have some kind of role model to just check what you're doing, to say, am I going in the right direction or am I going off on one? Because if you go off on one and you lose your audience or you lose your editor or whatever. So the modern fiction book that I use as a role model is Luke Jennings, who is the author of Codename Villanelle, which is the basis for Killing Eve. And although he's very overshadowed by the television series, readers of Luke Jennings, I think, myself included, and Lisa, my wife, feels very strongly the same way, that the books are actually better. And they're very readable. So many spy books don't actually work for me. I'm not quite sure why. So, for instance, although I like film versions of John le Carré, I tried reading some of the Smiley novels, and I couldn't really get into them. But Luke Jennings, I find very accessible. And so he's a modern basis, I think, for, you know, with a lot of structure. And I think it's because he writes in a relatively summarized way. I mean, when his books first came out, they were novellas. And so he really gets to the point. Now, I think that's his strength, and in my case, it is a potential weakness, because in comics, you really cut to the chase. Everything is very summarized. So it's quite a shock when you switch to text and you have to describe things that you either left to the artist or maybe didn't even matter, because in comics, everything is quite fast and you leave a certain amount to the reader's imagination. Whereas in a text novel, you've got to spell it out a lot more, and to create a sense of scene. And I found Luke Jennings was good for that. So that would be one example. Another one, I think, in terms of television series, would be, let's say, Mad Men, where you've got this really long-running series, and you start to learn more about the characters and... I found that quite useful, structure-wise. It's has a good discipline about it. And it kind of relates to what I'm writing about, because I have individual, well, just like I suppose so many stories, you have individual dramas as part of a sustained drama, which eventually leads to a punchline, whether it's series 6, 7, or 8. And the same is true with Breaking Bad, which I think perhaps follows the rule of ascending drama better than anything else. In other words, there's nothing horizontal about things. Things just get worse and worse and worse. You're thinking, oh my God, how are they going to top this? And if they don't, the thing is going to go down, it's going to deflate. So by the end of Breaking Bad, you're thinking, oh my God, this is horrendous. But it keeps you on the edge of your seat. So that rule of ascending drama is at the heart of creative writing. And I think I cover it in Page Turners, but my nonfiction Bible, which I always refer to, is Robert McKee's Story, which, although it's ostensibly designed for film and television, I think it also applies to novels and comics. In fact, I think not just myself, but John Wagner and Alan Grant, I think they went to one of his seminars, as did I. And it was a great experience. And he stopped doing those seminars, but he is on the web. So, you know, you can subscribe and see the great man in action. And I haven't done that because I've done the seminar, and I think the web would, perhaps I wouldn't see as much of his character and his personality come through. But anyway, his book Story is great, and I would recommend the web version as well, as so many authors, so many directors, so many actors, they all rate Robert McKee.
You mentioned disturbing the equilibrium in writing, in stories, and how that provokes story and creativity. If we go back to the 1970s comics that you were so involved with creating, were they in themselves an attempt to disturb the equilibrium of a slightly middle class and cozy British comic industry before that?
Yeah, I think they were. Undoubtedly they were. And it wasn't just on my side. It was also on Girls Comics with Gerry Finley Day. And I always say, when people talk about, my start in the comic revolution, I always say, no, it was Gerry. Gerry started it all with his Girls Comics. And John Wagler and I came into the equation shortly thereafter. But Gerry was doing the most astonishing stories on Tammy. And of course, if one was to look at them now, that some of them will have aged not so well. And also it depends what period that you're looking at, just as it does with 2000 AD. You look at one period of 2000 AD and you think, God, what's all the fuss about? And then you look at another era and you think, my God, this is genius. So it was the same with Tammy. You had to find the right period. But they were the first to really hit this kind of working class edge that comes through in Battle, Action, and 2000 AD. I mean, in the case of Battle, not just Charlie's War, but even from the get-go, a resistance towards officers. Now, I know there are exceptions to that. There's the superb Major Easy and so forth. But I actually had a rule at the beginning, which did get broken inevitably, which was not to feature officers as heroes. I think that's probably some kind of working class chip on my shoulder, but it happened to coincide, and the readers responded favorably to it. Whereas if you look at Warlord by comparison, which was a fantastic trailblazer, I mean, they were the first to really pioneer these big images, which we picked up on in Battle, but they still had those vestiges from the past. The prime character, the title character, Warlord, is an aristocrat. So we're still back to the kind of Scarlet Pimpernel. I mean, you know, you look at this stuff is being fed into readers' minds. And, you know, I think probably most people will say, well, so what? What does it matter? It matters a lot. I mean, you look at Scarlet Pimpernel, it's a great premise. I loved it as a kid. But at the end of the day, it's an aristocrat saving saving other aristocrats who had committed appalling crimes against the French people. So that's all going in. If you look at every, just about every fictional, traditional hero, whether it's James Bond, Sherlock Holmes, or whatever, they all went to Eton or some other public school. They've all, you know, they're, and so it's saying we are the heroes and they're not the fucking heroes and they need to be knocked down off those perches or we need a strong alternative to that. And so you can see, I feel that strongly about it even right now after a lifetime of writing subversive stories. You can imagine how I felt when I was writing Battle, maybe not quite so coherent, because one of the things when you do the same job for a lifetime is you get to reflect on, well, why are you doing it? What's it all about? But there was that considerable anger. And again, it comes forth in action, the same thing. And you have to bear in mind, there were opportunities there for it to happen. I mean, if you think of some of the films of the late 60s and 70s, films like Scum, for example, where you've got the protagonist as some kind of Borstal hero. Or if you looked at the catalogue of New English Library, where you've got a whole succession of politically correct, some questionable titles. I'm thinking of Gore, for example, G-O-R, which is, I don't think it could be published today. But you had some fantastic things like a story about a corrupt cop, who I think was called Terry Sneed. So they had titles like Sir, You Bastard. So the climate was good. And even other stories like, say, James Herbert's The Rats or the Pan books of horror stories were aiming at a large audience that could on occasion be described as working class. And subsequently, that has diminished a bit, I think. And there's a reason for it, which is that it's much harder. And this has been the subject of articles in The Guardian, The Independent, and elsewhere. It's much harder for actors and authors who have an ordinary background to get into the various forms of the media than it was back in the 70s. It was much easier then. On a very practical level, one example that's often quoted is, well, I mean, essentially, from memory, I think you've got five big publishers. They may have lots of different names, you know, subtitles, but they're all, you know, essentially Random House. I don't know if Penguin is part of that or whether it's a separate one. And one of the things that happens is they have interns. So now if you're an intern and the publisher's in London, well, you've got to come from a fairly wealthy background, haven't you? You know, you can't be a working class teenager and saying, you know, please, sir, I'd like to be an intern. Where are you going to live? You know, in a skip. So there was a kind of, in the 60s, there was a tremendous move in the 60s towards working class heroes. And that carried on through into the 70s. Obviously, it influenced me in the 60s, and if you like, I kind of harvested it in the 70s. But today, you know, it would be tough. The good news is, of course, which we may get onto, is independent publishing. So in other words, you can say Sodom and go your own way.
Of those 70s, those great 70s comics, I put this in our notes. Are there any that you think should still be going or could have survived or could even be revived today with a successful audience?
I think all potentially could. And it comes up from time to time. And, you know, to their credit, you see Rebellion. I think they try to do, let's say, I don't know, a one-off Misty or a one-off Battle or even a series of Battle comics with Garth. And possibly there's something, I think they something on Action. you have one overwhelming problem, which is the newsstand. And one of the reasons I did Space Warp was to prove to myself, never mind anybody else, that the newsstand is viable. It's a hell of a hard work. But we actually got Space Warp on the newsstand, and I know other people have as well. Now, the reason it's not on the newsstand as of this moment is more to do with logistics, the fact that, we're a two-person band and other things. But the potential to be on the newsstand is still there. But if you're going to be selling through comic shops and so forth, so say you're going to do a battle series and you're only going to be running it through comic shops or on Amazon or whatever, you're not reaching that audience, that audience, those 11, 12 and upwards kids who say, oh, I like the look of that, I'll check that out. That's very, very different to the comic shop. And so that's the thing that holds us back. It's not, and also this is the other thing, of course, is, yeah, I mean, you'll find people will say, yeah, we could do another Toxic, or we could do another battle action or crisis. But if, for example, and this again is getting to the problems with it, is they're all theoretically possible. I mean, there should be another battle comic. Okay, it might need, you know, I mean, if you consider, say, Commando's been going all this time. That's an incredible achievement. But what it means is that the appetite for war stories told in a responsible and an appropriate way is still there today. And, of course, in times gone by, there were a lot more. There was Air Ace Library and all sorts of variants. But the people are interested in war and what it means and the conflict. And today we'll cover things like PTSD and so forth. And I think Charlie's War and perhaps others showed that that was possible. So that's one direction. Action speaks for itself. It's a comic of true rebellion. And there's plenty to rebel about today. But the thing that holds them back is not just the newsstand. It's another thing as well, which I only thought about maybe a couple of years ago, I think, because, you find, well, why isn't somebody else doing one of these things? And the reason is because when John Wagner and I did our various comics together, we were freelance, right? So that meant if it didn't work out, well, we're out of a job, so we have to make it work. So when I'm doing 2000 AD, especially because there was a lot of resistance to it from within the industry, they all wanted to see it fail, which is a very much part of our the British comic culture. Is they love things failing; they absolutely relish it. But the people who are putting together, shall we say, the best of Battle or Best of Misty or whatever, their staff. So they're going to put a lot of effort into it, but they're not going to burn the midnight oil. You know what I mean? They're not going to be working every hour imaginable. And because their job is secure. The great thing and the bad thing about being a freelancer is you're never secure. You know what I mean? So you've got to really go that extra mile and say, how do I make this work? And, so those are the things that hold it back. But the actual subject matter, whether it's Crisis or Misty, they're all valid, and many others as well, which I get into in Page Turners. In particular, one that I actually got quite deeply involved in, which was a football comic. If you got a football comic right, my God, kids would be just, you know, they would really go for it because... And by that, I don't mean Roy of the Rovers. I mean with some controversy behind it, you know, without getting too adult, without getting into WAGs and all that kind of stuff. There's so much there because it's a working class kid's way of getting on in life, becoming someone. And of course, there are many, many casualties along the way for all sorts of reasons. And so I actually talked to a top sports writer about this, and because there was an entrepreneur who was interested in doing one. But as so often happens with entrepreneurs, they, you know, they're thinking, oh yeah, well, maybe we could do this, and then it all goes cold for various reasons. So all those potential for newsstand comics is still there. And the one thing that I think has now disappeared, those snide critics back at the beginning of the millennium saying, oh, well, kids aren't into comics anymore because, you know, they're into computer games instead. Well, of course they're into computer games, but that's because there aren't any, you know, they can read comics and play computer games, as do the French. So I would raise this, and they say, oh, well, the French are different. And you think, my God, there's so much defeatism. I think defeatism is the other gorilla in the corner in British comics. There is a real, there always has been an appetite for defeatism, which goes back to when John Wagner and I started. And John Wagner, myself, and Jerry Finley Day must have been the staffers' worst nightmare. Because you only realize this in retrospect. They were looking for their redundancy. And along come these three long-haired guys saying, no, we're going to shake the industry up. We're going to produce new stuff. And they're thinking, my God, there goes my redundancy. I was really looking forward to this. You know, I was just going to sink into the sand. And no, I can't. I've got to keep on working. So it kind of explains why we were all, I think myself especially, probably because I'm rather more mouthy than John and Jerry, I think that's probably why we were deeply resented. And I still feel echoes of that staffer attitude to this very day. It's a toxin that hasn't completely gone away.
Page Turners was published by the Millsverse. Space Warp, you've mentioned, you've done. Is independent self-publishing a game changer? Is it the way that writers and artists and creatives now can sort of get rid of that staffer problem?
It's tough.
Right.
Yes. The short answer is, yeah, it is doable. And I mean, we've got, Lisa and I, we've got 20 titles, 12 of which are Requiem Vampire Night.
Volume 12 is now out.
Volume 12 is now out and is available digitally in English on Gumroad, which is millsverse.gumroad.com. And the answer is, yeah, I mean, we've made it work, but it is very, very hard work. And I think that's worth going into a little bit. My feeling is that if you want to go down the comic road and you haven't got an entrepreneur who's going to say, hey, let's do a football comic or let's do a girl's magic comic, if you haven't got one of those behind you, what are you going to do? I think the answer is to perhaps consider a YA graphic novel, you know, if it's to do with, say, for example, I mean, it's already been covered and very well, gay issues and so forth. So in other words, it's something that is going to appeal to that very easily and very obviously. Now, there's no reason why that couldn't be self-published. Issues like distribution come into it as well. I cover some of these aspects of distribution, digital, and so on. It's a big subject. And I mean, Lisa and I are still learning after some 10 years of self-publishing because comics is very much a niche market. And if, for example, we were doing, let's say, I don't know, some what would traditionally be called Mills and Boone, if we were doing a romance thing, I mean, some of them are quite weird, like sort of Twilight stuff, but perhaps a bit saucier. They are big sellers. So if I was doing a text novel about, you know, werewolves and stuff like that, that would probably sell better than comics. arguably spy novels, because there's a tremendous consumption of those. The comic audience is much more specialized, so it's that little bit harder to make work. It's really got to be at the top of your game. And that's why I think a kind of YA graphic novel might be a simpler route. And there's things, it's still developing. I mean, I'm still learning and there's still variants of it. There's webtoons, for example, the Korean concept, which is now really taken off in France. And therefore, I would assume in the next, if it isn't here already, that there's a lot of British young people looking at webtoons on their phones. So I think the whole potential is there, but there's a lot to learn. There's no shortcuts. I wish there were. But, you know, so not only do I sort of have to think about my, you know, my fantasy world of characters that I want to lose myself in, I've got to think, right, I've got to listen to this podcast about how to get your Facebook ads working. And poor Lisa has to listen to these things all day because there is an art to that. And it's just part of the job now. The days, and if they ever really existed, I wonder. The days when you could just leave it all to a benign publisher who would make it work and, you know, you just come along and sign a few books and collect your royalties, that they've long gone.
Now, Requiem Vampire Night, we did an episode about the first volume of that, actually. You work with Olivier Ledroit. I'm not sure if I'm saying his last name correctly. Of course, you've worked with some really truly great artists, and you've had very successful and long-running collaborations with some of them. Who do you feel has understood your work best and delivered your vision most effectively over the years? Are there any names you'd like to pick out?
Well, I think there's four. That tells you how lucky and how privileged I have been. And in no particular order, I would say. But, I mean, Dave Gibbons is got to be one of the world's greatest storytellers. You know, whether it's working with Frank Miller or Alan Moore or myself or whatever. I mean, he really knows how to tell a story. And so he has to be there. Then you've got Kevin O'Neill, who, of course, not only brings out the humor in your stories, but will probably add to it, almost certainly add to it, with a lot of humor of his own. So he certainly needs remembering. And who else would there be? I think ultimately, if I had to make a choice, I would be torn a little bit between Olivier Ledroit on Requiem and also on another series that we're just putting back as a Kickstarter, Char. Char came before Requiem, and so we're putting that together as a...
I've just been reading about Char on your Iconoblast this week.
Yeah.
On your Substack.
Char is so interesting, I think, particularly for 2000 AD readers, because it has lots of 2000 AD elements, and yet they never came from me. They came from Olivia. He'd come up with these. He'd say, let's do this crazy death game. And he'd never read 2000 AD. And, you know, when you look at the final result, you think, oh, my God, this is like Harlem Heroes or Inferno or whatever. But I think ultimately the artist I was probably most in sync with would have to be Joe Cahoon on Charlie's War. I mean, he was so locked into what I was seeing, what I was writing about. And once again, like Kevin and the other artists, he would add something of himself to it as well. He wasn't just doing what's in the picture description. He brought a vibrancy to it. And I think Joe in particular is a good advert for, he understood people. Now, whether that comes with age or not, I don't know. But I mean, you look at his characters, he really understands people. Well, was that to do with maturity? I don't know. But, I mean, I was writing at the time, early 30s or something. So I only knew people up to a certain level, but Joe really understood them. So they were never caricatures. I mean, there's individual scenes where you've got a group of Germans who are being forcibly volunteered for some mission or other. And everyone is a character. And that, of course, is also true for other comic greats. I'm just trying to see if I can find it. Like Brian Bolland would say to me, everyone I draw, I have to see as a character. And that makes all the difference. He really had an understanding that was just astonishing. So I was just looking to see if I could find that particular one. And he invariably showed the officer class in a very negative way. And I think, and I'm not even sure that was entirely me. Oh, yeah, I've found the one in question. I think these are volunteers. So I don't know if you can see that on the screen there.
Oh, yes, I remember this page, yes.
Yeah, so you've got that wonderful page there with all these different chaps. You know, everyone's a person. Let me just see. I'm just trying to remember what it's about. The one in particular I like is this little guy down here, who's been volunteered for something. And that's so important that, particularly, I think, right through to the 70s, I think, certainly the whole of the 60s and obviously the 50s, Germans were shown as in a very crude, caricatured way. You know, they were, they weren't seen as people. And so I think we did a lot to change that with Charlie's War and also in Action, Hellman of Hammer Force and stories like that.
So if we were to play the Grail Page game and imagine that the artworks all survived and we could afford it, would that be your Grail Page from Charlie's War?
Yeah, it would. Now, the one I wouldn't go for, because I, in a fantasy world, I know there would be so many other people queuing up for that page, and I wouldn't want to trump them, is the page with the Charlie with the bag of Ginger's remains.
Ginger.
My mate Ginger. Yeah, that's the one scene that I think that, you know, moves everyone. And so I think it's almost too painful, I think, in some ways. So the page I've chosen is the end of the Battle of the Somme, which I even to this day, I don't... Let me get it up there.
Oh, right, yes.
I think we've got it.
Let's
see. Yeah. So that's the end of the Battle of the Somme. Now, even to this day, I try not to read the text because it just makes me so not just sad for those people that died, but it also makes me angry because there is a calculated attempt by the revisionist historians to turn the disaster of the Somme into some patriotic victory. I mean, there was the BBC even ran a documentary, quite a major one, called something like The Somme, From Defeat to Victory. It was a disaster. It was, and it was much worse than that. It was a cull. The best of British were killed there. And, you know, how far one wants to go down the rabbit hole there is way outside Charlie's War. But that's an important page. And just while we're on the subject, that's what inspired me. I really thought I'd close the book on Charlie's War. I thought everyone knew that World War One was a total disaster. And then you have the revisionists coming along from the end of the 90s and saying, no, actually, Germany was evil, Britain was good, And it was actually the generals were not the butchers. You know, that's just a lot of hippie nonsense, which, of course, it wasn't. There's nothing hippie about it at all. You had accepted authors from all kinds of backgrounds criticizing World War One, and so I felt I had to do something about it. That's the muse again. In other words, I mean, if it was left to my choice, I'd probably just, I don't know what I'd be doing. Commercially, probably the best thing to do would be to write girls' comics because they're actually easy to write and there's a strong market. And if I'd found my niche, I'd probably... But the muse says, no, you've got to write something. You've got to write a sequel to Charlie's War. And the only appropriate sequel is in a text novel, which deals with, I like to think in an entertaining way, the propaganda behind World War One. Because the propaganda that was used then, you see exactly the same thing today. I think they were actually better at it in World War One. They knew how to lie to the British public in quite a clever way. Whereas when you look at the headlines today, whatever they're up to, you're thinking, you're a bunch of liars. You know what I mean? So it's I'm actually talking about it's... The protagonist is a kind of version of Charlie in many ways. I mean, he might be a bit more literate, but only just. And he works for MI7, which is the Department of Propaganda, which is straight out of George Orwell. So there's a lot of comedy and there's a lot of pathos and there's a lot of tragedy connected to it. So that's what I'm working on. Apart from anything else, I'm driven by it. I have to do it, so I have no choice.
Well, as ever, I will post these pages from Charlie's War on the social media when this episode comes out so people can see what we've been talking about, and in particular the last page of the Battle of the Somme that's now become your Grail page in the Grail page gallery. Pat, page-turners... I'm going to finish with a sort of story that you tell towards the end of the book, because, of course, any creator with a big back catalogue like yourself will have had several experiences of properties being optioned by film and television, and then either nothing ever comes of it or they have a bad experience. You've had, of course, two Accident Man movies with Scott Adkins, but then, of course, last November when your book came out... Doctor Who returned to our screens, and it returned with the Star Beast. And I know from the book and from seeing Doctor Who Unleashed that you and Dave had quite a fun time. I think it's just over 2 years ago now that you were sort of smuggled into the set, weren't you? Tell us about working with Russell T. Davis and the Doctor Who team.
It was a great experience. It started off where... when we turned up at the Bad Wolf Studios, we had to have a COVID test. Now, if that had proved, was it positive or negative, we'd have been sent home. But fortunately, we were both okay, which was a bit of a miracle, considering in my case, at least, I'd been flying on Ryanair, breathing in all those germs. But sadly, Russell had come down with COVID, so he was gutted that, and so were we, that we didn't actually get to meet him. But I've been in correspondence with him, and he's a lovely chap. Oh, it was just an astonishing day, and I think I don't think there's a photo of us, unfortunately, where I'm looking at the new TARDIS, which is the new big budget one, but my chin completely dropped. It was like, oh my God, this is just amazing. So there's a whole section on the whole Doctor, my whole Doctor Who experience, because alongside 2000 AD, Doctor Who was an important part of my writing career. But they looked after us so well. And the great thing about it was they didn't have to. It was just a purely generous thing they wanted to do. I mean, unlike elsewhere in the world of, what should we say, British fantasy, where they can be very different. It's like, well, we own the rights, bugger off kind of thing. They just they took us all around the Doctor Who set, hence the TARDIS and the interior of the home where the Star Beast and the woodshed and all this kind of stuff. And it was just like one shock after another. And, of course, they didn't tell us what was going on because they wanted to capture our startled reactions. And so we had no idea who was the Doctor, because at that point it had been so we didn't know. So it came as a huge shock, you know, when it was David Tennant. And because we were thinking, oh, how's all this going to work? So it was absolutely thrilling. And speaking for myself, I was starstruck. I didn't really know what to say, which is unusual for me. As you can see, I've usually got plenty to say, but it's like, I think it was almost too many shocks for one day. I was completely spaced out.
It's unusual that because Tony and I were messaging when the episode dropped, and it's unusual that we were shocked to see yours and Dave Gibbons' name right on the title screen for the episode, which compared to the way that some comic book creators have been treated by film and television, was remarkable. And it was so wonderful to see. It was a big moment for us and for British comics.
Yeah, that was really lovely. And it was great to get all that appreciation from fans as well, because it meant that there was proper recognition. Whereas you've doubtless heard the story, which I think I've talked about before, where I was the really militant on the first Judge Dredd movie to say, look, everyone must have credits, on-screen credits. And they really didn't want to do it. And I wouldn't sign off until we got the credits. And they got their revenge. You probably know the story, but not everyone may. They got their revenge. They made them so tiny. They're right down there with the Dolby sound. You know, they're you can barely read it. In other words, and there was a lot of credits. I think Kevin, Nick McMahon, Brian Bolland, myself, Carlos, and John, obviously. And to get proper credits was really heartwarming. Yeah, it's great. And at the end where they talk about the Wrath Warriors, I think there's a further credit there, and so on. Yeah, it's a role model for others. But yes, Doctor Who has always been like that. I mean, the audios, the audio plays, they're very good.
Yes, and you've written for Big Finish, yeah, and they've adapted those stories for Big Finish.
And they always have a very respectful attitude. And it's a pity it doesn't apply elsewhere, because it's not a calculated thing, but you get so much more in return. If you're generous with your proper credits and time and appreciation and so on, the fans like it, the creators like it, and probably more things happen as a result. You know, better things happen, or you feel, oh, I'll go that extra mile for this particular company.
Yeah. Remarkable. So, Pat, Page Turner's How to Create Iconic Stories from the Creator of 2000 AD is available in paperback and digitally. You can find it and your other books on the millsverse.com.
I would say for Requiem, the Millsverse site is currently needing updating. It's one of the problems of a two-person band. So I would say the best thing to do is to go to iconoblast.substack.com, or it's on Amazon. Requiem, yeah, you can go to millsverse.gumroad.com for Requiem Digital. But otherwise, I would go to Substack, which has kind of taken over really from Millsverse, because it's a very accessible way of writing about things. So that's kicked in. Oh, and before I forget, I don't know, if you're going to mention it, we have the successor to Spacewarp Hellbreaker is in the works, and we're probably, I would guess, around 6 months away from that appearing in print.
Excellent. I look forward to some more Space Warp. I look forward to continuing to read your Iconoblast Substack, which I subscribe to and is great fun, particularly the secret history of Nemesis the Warlock that you're running to tie in with the definitive edition that was published recently. I know you were quite impressed with the definitive edition of your work.
Yeah, that Rebellion have done a fantastic job, yeah.
And I see it's only just been recently announced there's a similar edition of Slain possibly coming next year, which will finally get Angela Kincaid's name on the front cover along with yours.
That would be nice. That would be really, really nice to see because, I mean, that's the thing. When you start a story, as Angela did, you've got just a blank sheet of paper. And now, of course, it's gone on from there to new heights with Glenn Fabry and Simon Bisley and so on. But yeah, creating is the hardest bit because you just got a blank page and it can go anywhere and it could have been a disaster. So yeah, it's good that that's properly acknowledged. I think what's happening with Rebellion, I mean, you must have, you've probably doubtless commented on this, that I think the times when Rebellion would do these cheaper and much more, you know, quick editions of various books, I think that time seems to be over and they're going for real classics with a higher price and a higher quality level because they know that if they don't have that quality level, that long-term fans aren't going to buy them. So that seems to be what's happening. You're getting definitive editions. I think there's a special edition of Simon Bisley's The Horned God.
Yes.
Coming out or is on.
That's due soon as well, yes.
Yeah. And I think that's great. I mean, the only problem, of course, is that stories which are still good but haven't, for whatever reason, attracted such a big fan following, they're probably going to fall by the wayside, at least for now, which is a pity. But that seems to be the pattern with Rebellion. And I can understand the economics of that. If you have a beautiful edition with, you know, special bindings and all the rest of it. And the Nemesis ones are just astonishing. So it's great. Great designers they've got.
Let's hope that next year's Slain Definitive Edition is equally as good, because the Nemesis one is wonderful. You're quite right. Absolutely superb. Pat, thank you so much for giving up your time this morning to talk about page turners and to tell me some of the important stuff that's in the book. Like I say, I was at the convention and people were telling me how much they'd enjoyed it and how much they'd found it helpful for their own work. Page Turners by Pat Mills. And if you look in the show notes for this episode and on the website for this episode, you will find all of Pat's links to all of his current projects. You continue to be very busy, Pat.
Yeah, I know. It's a bit scary, isn't it, at my advanced years?
No signs of slowing down.
Reflect. Yeah, I think it's, because I still do a lot of work for France. There's a whole bunch of stories I'm involved in there. It's partly for economics, but it is also coming back again to the muse. So, for instance, the Sean Stone story about MI7 and propaganda. I think economics to one side, if I wasn't driven by the muse, I certainly wouldn't be writing it. I mean, I think, okay, well, I've got a big enough body of work, whatever, you know. No, I have to do it. So blame it on the muse. In other words, you get in touch with what drives you. And then maybe you think, well, maybe I'd have been better off just, you know, knocking it out, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's the reason why there's so much work out there. She keeps me busy.
The muse still has you in her grips, and long may it continue, Pat.
I feared you'd say that.
And a huge thank you to Pat for, not just for this morning, but for everything you've done for British Comics. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you so much, Eamon. And it's great talking to you, and also to your listeners for tuning in.
Thank you so much. And thanks to Tony for putting us in touch. Thank you for everyone for listening to Megacity Book Club. As ever, find all of the links to Pat's work at megacitybookclub.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and the 2000 AD forums. Follow Pat's Substack at Iconoblast. Or email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you've got any comments or queries or a book of your own that you'd like to come and talk about. So until next time, it's a goodbye from me and...
Goodbye from me. Wow.